my mom always felt like the story was special and was worth telling, and that the attention that it got was truly deserved attention because the story is so powerful. But I don't think that there's any way in our wildest dreams that we ever could have imagined that things would have gone this way.
Here at Steady State Podcast, we are really interested in backstories, real life experiences on and off the water that make people the rowers, coaches, and coxswains they are today. From indoor rowing to flat water masters to coastal and ocean adventurers, we celebrate you who represent the global humanity of our sport. Together, we disrupt and expand the narrative about rowing culture. We're your hosts, Tara Morgan
and Rachel Friedman. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. If you're coming back for another episode, thanks for being here.
Steady State Podcast is sponsored in part by Concept 2 and EB5 Investors. The Boys in the Boat hit bookstore shelves 10 years ago, telling the true story of the University of Washington rowing team thrust into the spotlight as they competed for gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. The book became a worldwide phenomenon, and now a George Clooney-directed movie adaptation is set to open in movie theaters on Christmas Day. Joe Rantz, the central character in the book, was born in Washington State, where we catch up with his granddaughter, Jennifer Huffman, a successful master's rower in her own right. We talk about the power of rowing and seeing her grandpa brought to life on the big screen.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Huffman, and you're listening to Steady State Podcast. Sit ready. I learned how to row in 2009 at North Cascades Crew on Lake Stevens. I've also rowed for College Club Seattle on Lake Union. I have dabbled in novice rowing coaching for youth. That was a number of years ago, but my primary coaching job is at North Shore Gymnastics Center in Woodinville, Washington.
So Jen, thank you so much for being with us today. First question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how has your past rowing week been?
This has actually been kind of an interesting week. I'd say my rowing week as a whole, probably about a 6. We had a lot of fog and really cold, kind of nasty weather this week. So I rowed on Monday, Friday, Saturday, and then did a sushi on Sunday, which was super fun.
Oh, what did you do? Sushi race.
Sushi race.
I don't know what that is. Tell me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So In Seattle, there's a guy at Pocock that puts on sushi races just out of the goodness of his heart to let people go out and race during, basically they start in like maybe September and then run through the end of the year. So there's a little restaurant down at the south end of Lake Union called I Love Sushi. And so we race from I Love Sushi all the way up Lake Union. It goes around the corner at Pocock, through Portage Bay, through Montlake Cut, and then finishes at the start line of the Husky Race Course, which is about 6K and change.
Tara, have you done these before? I think you may have mentioned sushi races to me.
So sushi races are really interesting because it's kind of a any comers can do the sushi race, and you just have the point where you start and you show up. So if you're putting together just a boat for head racing and you really want a kind of slightly competitive environment, or you want to just time yourself and or have support while you're on the water, it's a really fun event.
It's fun. It's a real deal in terms of actually going out and racing against other people. It just kind of takes the, I don't want to say the fear out of head racing, but it makes it less of a big deal because you're doing it all the time.
So Jen, you're rowing for College Club, is that right?
Yes. So for sweep rowing, our season ends pretty much right after Head of the Lake at the beginning of November. And then we start back up in late February, but I row straight through sculling, 5:30 a.m. sharp. So I'll row straight through the winter, probably 3 to 4 days a week.
Yeah. And Lake Union, where you're rowing, is that where you're trailering down to Lake Union? You have a boat on Lake Union?
I have a boat at College Club. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so for our listeners, Lake Union is like the hub of rowing for Seattle. There's probably 15 boat clubs just on that waterway alone. Rachel and I did a really fun launch boat tour of that mm-hmm. waterway when we
that
were-
blew my mind when I was when
it
I
is
saw
pretty
it.
Crazy. I mean, yeah. It's not even that big a body of water, and there's yeah. just so many boathouses.
So many. And yeah, and both Rachel and I love going to like the Schuylkill and going to Boston, you know, and seeing all the boathouses and the community, and Lake Union's no different. But the cool thing about Lake Union is the ambient lighting from mm-hmm. the commercial activity and the fact that you're in the middle of a big city. So the rules that apply to a lot of clubs about rowing in the dark.
I don't know how helpful ambient light is sometimes. It's mm-hmm. like then you're trying yeah. to, you know, you're trying to figure out, okay, what is a boat and what is docks on the shore or, you know, that kind of stuff.
We're going to move on to our hot seat Q&A. As a listener, I think you know what we do here, but to help our listeners get to know our guests, we put you through a lightning round of questions we call the hot seat. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Port or starboard?
Port.
Sweep or skull?
Equal.
Mm.
I like both sweep and skull.
Bow seat, stroke seat, or engine room?
In a sculling boat, I'd say bow seat. In sweep boat, I'd say engine room.
Head race or sprint race?
Head race, but barely.
uni suit or tank and trow?
Uni 100.
I think 2024 might be my year of the uni, like the aspirational aspect of it.
Oh, I like that, Tara. Last year was commit to fit. Now we're going to hashtag uni.
Hashtag year of the uni.
Favorite coxswain command to give or receive?
Seats on the run. That is my favorite coxswain command. We hear that a lot when we're getting ready for Head of the Charles from our coxswain.
And you want to give your coxswain a shout out?
I do. Becky is the best coxswain ever. We've had her for the last couple of years racing at Head of the Charles, and she's amazing.
So put this in context for me. Seats on the run. When would she use that?
So she'd use that when we're on a straightaway. We're thinking about our send and being smooth and nice and long. So we're taking seats on the run of the boat. That's the goal.
I like nice. It. I'm tucking that away for use.
There you
in
go.
2024. Yep.
Favorite place to row?
I think Boston, Head of the Charles, got to be my favorite place to row. Yeah. Although I will say close second is Burnaby Lake in Canada is a really fun place to row.
Yes.
Love Burnaby Lake.
Love yeah. Burnaby. Yeah. Beautiful. It's like an estuary. You're rowing yeah. an estuary. Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Best piece of rowing advice you ever received?
Buy your own sculling oars. I did that very early on, and I can't imagine not having my own oars to row with now.
Even if you're borrowing a boat from somewhere else, do you always bring your oars?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I've never heard that before.
It's like an extension to your hand. You know, it's like, I don't know, there's something about having your own oars that just feels familiar, even if you're not in your own boat.
Okay. Coffee before or after a row?
I do black tea before and latte after.
Oh, I love that combo. I'm a black tea yeah. person. Yeah.
Earl Grey is my favorite.
I'm going to go sideways there. I'm going to go English breakfast.
I don't mind English breakfast. Earl Grey is. Earl Grey takes top spot.
Hashtag Trader Joe's decaf black tea.
I'm a green tea drinker myself.
But both Rachel and I agree on one thing, and that is good chai. Like 100% chai. Okay. In 2013, when author Daniel James Brown published Boys in the Boat, people around the world were mesmerized by Joe Rance and his story of struggle and achievement. To you, Joe is grandpa. What did you know about his rowing life when you were a kid and growing up with him?
Not a whole lot, besides the fact that I knew that he had won the Olympics and I knew that he was a rower. He didn't talk about it really at all as we were growing up. There wasn't any expectation that I was going to row. So it was always just kind of in the background. The medal was on the mantle at their house. He had his Poughkeepsie Cups on the bookcase. And that's really all it was to us at that point.
Will you tell us a little bit about him?
I knew my grandpa really well growing up. We were over there a lot. They lived in Lake Forest Park and we lived in Linwood. I mean, that's only maybe a 20-minute drive. So we'd go over there at least once a week the entire time that I was growing up. And then during the summer, we'd go over there and live with them for 4 weeks while we had our gymnastics camp that was a 4-week camp during the summer, both my brother and I. I always thought of Grandpa as someone who was especially caring and giving and really liked to learn, to impart wisdom. He had lots of interests and he really liked to share those interests with other people. He and Grandma used to square dance. And so he came out and taught square dancing to our elementary school, which was super fun. Or, you know, he has had a wood stove and was always very capable with automotive repair kind of stuff. And so he would teach how to stock your wood stove classes at the community school, or powder puff, like mechanic repair classes for women who wanted to learn how to change their oil back in the, you know, the 50s and 60s and that kind of thing. So always willing to help out, to teach, to listen, just kind of all around great guy.
You mentioned getting involved in gymnastics as a kid, and I know that he had been a gymnast for a bit. Did he talk about that at all? And did that influence you at all to get involved in gymnastics?
Yeah, no, I had no idea that he had done any gymnastics at all until we were looking at doing the scrapbook. That was the first time that I'd ever heard about that. So I was actually rather surprised. I was like, really? That's very interesting. So no, that had nothing to do with me getting started in gymnastics at all.
You know, and some of that I'm so fascinated by, especially, you know, folks of that generation, kind of no matter what their stories were, I feel like there just wasn't a whole lot of communicating with the next generation. They were a little bit more stoic, or they just didn't pass down some of those stories.
Right. I think that, I mean, obviously that's probably part of the reason why they're kind of called the silent generation. I think that there's a lot of things that they went through that probably they would really honestly rather not remember. And I think that that probably was kind of the case for Grandpa, although part of my mom kind of getting information out of him, because he lived with my mom for the last 5-ish years of his life. She was his caregiver, as he was too old to live on his own anymore. And my grandma had already passed away. There were a lot of things that she was curious about that he hadn't talked about really at all. And so she kind of followed him around with a pad of paper and a pencil for about the last 5 years of his life. And if he just happened to spontaneously remember something, or she would, you know, be right there and be like, can you tell me more about that? Or when did that happen? Or those kind of things, to try and get those little snippets of memory from him. And I think that one of her regrets is that there are things now, because of the book coming out, that she didn't ask the question. And so it's gone. But there's always going to be things after the fact that you're like, oh, I wish I would have asked that question.
We know from the lore of The Boys in the Boat, your mom was really integral in bringing Daniel James Brown into your family and into hearing your grandpa's stories. And what year did he pass away?
So he passed away in 2007.
And how long after that did you start rowing?
I started rowing in like late 2008. So not super long after.
His passing play a role in your decision to begin rowing?
In a weird roundabout way, yeah. So my son was friends with some kids in his band at school who were rowing at North Cascades Crew on Lake Stevens. And so they asked him to be a coxswain, because he was tiny when he was in like seventh and eighth grades. He really dislikes sports and outdoors and that kind of stuff. It was like, you know, great grandpa would be looking down from heaven and he'd be so excited if you tried something like this. So he very grudgingly said, okay, I'll go try it. He started coxing and then ended up eventually rowing for a short period of time. But some of the moms in that group were going to take a learn to row class at the same time, roughly, that I was starting. So about a month after Josh started rowing, then I took a learn to row class. So it wasn't really because of Grandpa, but getting Josh down there was because of Grandpa.
I've heard so many women tell really similar stories about their children starting to row and then getting involved at some point. I feel like I've heard so many more women tell that story than men. I'm sure that there are men who get involved, but it seems to be a lot of the moms.
Oftentimes those folks become the most passionate, and they're also not broken because they didn't start rowing in high school or college and they're coming at it basically pretty fresh. But Jen, you like, you got into the single and you really ran with it.
Yeah. When I took Learn to Row, we learned to row in at 8. So then 6 weeks after Learn to Row, we did the summer extravaganza regatta at Green Lake.
That was
entertaining. And my son actually coxed us at that race. Oh, so it was kind of fun. And then pretty much right after that, I was in a single, and by November did Tail of the Lake in a single that year. I enjoyed the single while I was doing it. I think now maybe the single isn't my favorite boat anymore. But I think it was my favorite boat at the point in time where I was in that boat a lot.
Okay, so two questions for you. So what made you fall in love with the single then? And then that transition into bigger boats, why do you think you're starting to fall in love with those boats?
I loved the single because that was the boat that I was in the most often. I also love the double. I think that there's a camaraderie that you have in the double when you're working toward a common goal. And really that was the biggest boat that I consistently raced in. But I always felt like I was competitive in the single, that it was fun to be able to go out and just do it by myself. As the book came out, and, you know, more and more talking about the camaraderie of bigger boats and that kind of thing. And I honestly didn't think that I was ever going to get to experience what that was like, because our club was so small and there just weren't that many rowers and we didn't row big boats at all. So it wasn't until I got invited to come and sub in at College Club and try rowing in the 8 that I really realized how special being able to row in an 8 is. And I'm just truly thankful that I got to experience that, because it was something that I had always wanted to do when I was only in a single and a double. And it was everything that I thought it was going to be in terms of just the teamwork, and the way that it feels to be in a big boat is like nothing else, for sure. Just the very limited amount of sweep rowing that I'd done at North Cascades, and every time I rode in the 8, it hurt my body. And then I had a couple of friends who had gone to Everett or gone to Sammamish, and they were rowing in big boats. And they're like, oh, you really should try rowing in big boats because you'd really like it. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know about that, because like every time I've been in it, it has not been the best experience. So I went out and it was like completely different when you're rowing with very experienced sweep rowers. It was amazing.
On our last episode, we took a look back at 2023, going behind the scenes of Steady State Podcast. Listen back for clips from some of our favorite season 4 episodes and big takeaways from interviews with nearly 40 guests last year. You'll also get a peek at what's to come for season 5 in 2024. If you missed it or any of our episodes, listen anytime at steadystatenetwork.com/podcast or anywhere you get podcasts.
You are a kids coach with North Shore Gymnastics. Tell us about gymnastics, why you love coaching and paying it forward.
So I started gymnastics when I was 7, and I actually started coaching when I was 14 for just a little, it was a little dance studio that kind of did gymnastics on the side. And I have just always been passionate about gymnastics and dance, and I love kids. Part of what's really neat about gymnastics is that the kids that I work with are mostly between 10 and 14 years old. And it's such an important time in kids' lives when they're learning how to be responsible, how to manage their time, how to work through adversity, how to set goals. There's so many things that we do in gymnastics, especially when you're looking at it through a competitive lens, that transfers over to life. And I just find that so fulfilling. And I also have a desk job during the day. And there's a lot of times when, you know, I'm coming to the gym and I'm kind of worn out and it's been a long day, but I always feel better when I leave after coaching.
Yeah. One of the things I've loved following is your personal social media. You post a lot about North Shore Gymnastics. And
yeah. Yep.
One of my favorite things that you post a lot of is progress videos. You're like, mm-hmm. look yep. what skill we nailed today. And you can tell yep. that these girls really love you. And you can tell that you really love being there with them and celebrating their wins and celebrating their adversity and challenges at their meets and stuff.
Well, and I think that the other thing that's fun too is especially a lot of the kids in this group, I've had them for maybe 4 or 5 years. So I've kind of moved up levels with them. We have a long history together and the girls have a long history together, and listening to them cheer each other on too in some of those videos is like, they're just so supportive of each other. It's mm-hmm. just, they're very, very close knit. So it's, mm-hmm. it's a lot of fun to coach and to really try and get kids to reach their potential in gymnastics.
Absolutely. And Tara and I can 100% back that and understand that as rowing coaches, you know, at every level.
Right.
There's that community right. that develops either through the boat or through the whole crew, and the support and seeing people overcome whatever it might be to right. figure out what their potential is.
Well, and it is interesting too, because I've helped with a lot of learn to row classes in my day, being like the bow seat in a quad with three other people who haven't rowed before, or helping learn to row classes in whatever way. And I feel like gymnastics coaching has kind of helped me with that too, because gymnastics is so physically demanding in terms of like, how do you tell someone what they need to do to fix something? And there's a lot of times where, you know, I'll have to tell a kid three different ways. I'll have to say something three different ways for them to actually, for it to click for mm-hmm. them, and for them to figure out what it is that they really need to do to fix something. And I think it's the same way in rowing.
Absolutely.
You know, if you want somebody to, you know, get their blade in the water quicker, it's like, okay, what are three ways that you can try and explain that so that they're going to get it? You know, mm-hmm. because until you've done it, you don't know what it feels like. Mm-hmm. And it's like being able to do that for the first time or two where you're like, oh, okay, I get it. I can feel that now. And the other thing that's interesting too, is just going from having coached for such a long time to being a novice in a sport as an adult.
Yeah.
I really remember what it was like to learn to row, and thinking about it from a coach's perspective mm-hmm. and trying to figure it out and refine my stroke, but also thinking, you know, when there were times that I just couldn't figure something out or it got really frustrating. And I remember thinking in the back of my head, dude, my coach is probably just going nuts right now because he's telling me to do something and I'm like, I can't figure it out. And, you know, yeah. so I'm looking at it from a coach's perspective. It's like, oh, he's going to see right through that excuse or whatever it is.
And yeah.
And then moving into the single, I mean, you're your own coxswain, you're your own mm-hmm. coach a lot of the time, especially if you don't row with a coached program or you just go out on your own and do your own thing. And you really have to tuck yourself off of all those ledges and just be like, okay,
yeah.
break it down, do a drill.
You know, you find the drills that you like. And that in itself too is really fulfilling, to be able to help kids take those first strokes and refine them and see their, you know, them have their light bulb aha moments and that kind of thing is they're learning. There's definitely times though where, you know, we're out on the water. I'm like, we should do this drill, or why are we doing this drill, or why aren't we doing this piece this direction? So I definitely find my mind going to that I want to be in control piece. And then I do have to take a breath and just say, okay, I'm not in charge of this boat and I need to just fill out.
Not your monkey, not your circus. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Although sometimes I desperately want to make it my monkey and it's really
yeah.
hard not to.
Oh, that happens to me all the time.
Well, yeah.
And, so but Rachel, I'm sure that's why I like Bao.
Yeah. Yeah. Rachel gets the advantage because she gets to cox.
Yeah. Those days I like when I'm coxing, I do like playing that role because it does put me in a leadership position and I can kind of, especially if we kind of walk away from some of the other boats, I can kind of do what I want to do with the crew. But certainly when I'm sitting in bow seat and I just am like, why the fuck are we doing this? I just right. have to take right. a few deep breaths yeah, and figure it out. Figure out what I'm learning that day.
Well, and I do have to say, you know, there's times where, you know, some of the conversation that goes on between like our coach and our coxswain, I feel like our coxswain is able to just really not say what I'm thinking. She's just being so calm and collected about this.
It's delicate because master rowers are typically very motivated people who are paying money and spending time and commuting mm-hmm. and coming in and have these competitive aspirations a lot of the time. And it's hard for them to let go of that CEO role or they're the mom right. role. And sometimes that can be kind of destructive in an eight when you hear someone in the bow or in middle go, why are we doing this drill? Like, what's the point of that?
I might have done that a few times.
I know. I think we've all been guilty of like, what's happening? Like,
As an aside, this year we picked up a new coxswain who's like maybe 2 or 3 years out of college. And it blew my mind how frank she was with the coaches. She was just like, coach. And she would just say exactly what was on her mind. I was like, I've never done that. Coach. Like, when I'm in the coxswain seat, the coach is the coach, and I might ask right. politely about something, but she was just right. like, mom, mom, mom. You know, like, whatever was on her mind. So,
oh, that's awesome. I love that she feels empowered enough to do that. So I want to ask about your rowing season. We saw you in Boston at Head of the Charles. Mm-hmm. I've seen you yep. on the lake here for Tail of the Lake and Head of the Lake. How has your rowing season been this year for 2023?
I think that we didn't do as much rowing competitively as we've done in the past, just more because scheduling didn't work out or regattas were further away and trailering is always difficult for our group. We did some good 2K warm-up racing to get ready for opening day. And then really pretty much we picked it up again competitively to kind of get ready for Head of the Charles. So I also went and raced during the summer with Station L, who is my favorite club down in Portland. I raced with them at Cascadia this summer. So that was super fun. And it's really nice to have friends at other clubs where, you know, I can just say, hey, do you have, you know, I'm going to go and just kind of hang out at this regatta anyway, because I love it. But if there's any boat that I could jump in while I'm there, you know, I'd really love to jump in a boat with you guys. And they're like, woohoo. Yeah. So I ended up racing, 4 races or 5 races at Cascadia. And that was super fun too.
I've done that with Willamette crew with Jenny Withicum and her crew.
Yeah. Oh, I love Jenny. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're, I think it's Oregon. It must be an Oregon thing that they're just like, sure. Hey, right. we need a woman. You're in your 40s or your 50s. And I don't think that happens enough at regattas. City State Podcast is sponsored in part by Breakwater Realty Group. Daydreaming of new lakes, rivers, and coastlines to row and play on? Consider a home in Maine. The Breakwater Realty Group, brokered by eXp Realty, can help you find your home away from home or relocate to a new primary home with ease. Connect with the team by visiting breakwaterrealtygroup.com and scheduling an obligation-free buying consultation. Maine, it's the way life should be.
Coming up on the next episode, we kick off season 5 with 3-time Olympic coxswain Mary Whipple. She held the 9th seat in the United States Women's 8 for 12 years, leading crews in 04, 08, and 2012 to the medal stand. With a Master's of Education in Intercollegiate Athletic Leadership from the University of Washington, Mary created the 9th seat, a resource for coxswains and ultimately a community for coxswains. She offers camps and clinics throughout the year. Catch new episodes of Steady State Podcast every other weekend, anywhere you get podcasts.
In 2, we're back with Jennifer Huffman. That's 1, 2. So The Boys in the Boat is a riveting retelling of how 9 working class boys shocked the world at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. Since being published in 2013, it has spent nearly 120 weeks in the top 10 on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list, including 15 weeks at number 1. At its emotional heart is Joe Rantz, your grandpa. What's the origin of Boys in the Boat? How did it get started?
I'll start off by saying that both my mom and I feel incredibly lucky that circumstances unfolded in the way that they did that allowed this book to happen, because it was truly just by lucky circumstance that everything turned out the way that it did. We moved Grandpa out of his house in about 2005, and we were moving things out of the attic and found a chest that had a lot of his Olympic memorabilia and rowing scrapbooks, and a lot of the stuff in there was not in good shape. And being a mom of two small kids who love to do scrapbooking, I was like, I think we need to put this stuff into an archival kind of a scrapbook that will keep it available for, you know, coming generations. I pulled the things out of his scrapbooks that I liked the most. And then he and I went to Conybear Shell House and looked through Conybear's old scrapbooks that had articles from the 1930s in them. And I picked out the articles that I liked the best from those scrapbooks, took pictures of them, printed them out, put them in the scrapbook along with some of my grandpa's stuff. And he helped me tell the story. We went through and he told me some, you know, some interesting stories about things that had happened in Germany when he was there and just kind of how events unfolded to get there. So he was kind of instrumental in me creating the scrapbook. And when it was done, my mom showed it to friends and, you know, people would look at it and they're like, oh my gosh, this would make such a great book. And, you know, she kind of started thinking about, yeah, this is how you could tell this story. Just having it in a format where it was his 4 years of rowing and you could see the whole story. So he was working on this stuff. There had been reporters that had come around and done stories on them or shown interest in the story as a whole and been talking to mom, and they're like, oh, let us go do some research and we'll get back to you. And then they would never get back to her. So he was worried that the story was going to be gone. There were very few of the guys that were actually left alive. I think by that point, there were only four of them. So she figured maybe she was going to have to tell it. At about that point in time, Dan Brown moved into her neighborhood, and they had gone to a homeowners association meeting, and he was there, and he's like, hey, so I just wrote my first book. It was just published. And if anybody wants to buy it, I'll sign it for you. So my mom bought it and she read it and was just absolutely intrigued with the way that he writes, because, you know, I mean, he's just so good at painting a picture. And this book is called Under a Flaming Sky, and it's about a firestorm in Hinckley, Minnesota in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. And she could see it as she's reading it. It's like, it was so potent that she was like, I would really like to talk to him and see whether maybe I could get his input on what I'm working on. And so she had given it to him, said, you know, hey, my dad was on the 1936 Olympic crew, and I'm trying to kind of write this story, and I was wondering if you'd take a look at it. And so he looked at it, and he's like, I'd be really happy to give you some advice on this, but if you don't want to write it, I would really like to take this on as my next book.
Nice.
So my mom started reading Dan's book to my grandpa, because she wanted, without saying that they'd had this conversation, she wanted him to kind of listen to the way that Dan writes and like Dan as an author. So she's reading this book to my grandpa, and my grandpa's like, I know the character in that story. I know Angus Hay. I played with a jazz band with him in high school in Squim. And my mom's like, I don't think that you're remembering that right, or I don't think that that could have happened, because this was in the 1890s and you weren't born until 1914. And my grandpa was very insistent that he knew Angus Hay and that they had played in a jazz band together in school. So my mom, the next time that she saw Dan, said, hey, so what happened to the family that was in that book after this whole firestorm was finished? And he said, well, I think they moved out to the Olympic Peninsula. So it actually was that family, but it was his son, Angus Hay Jr., that was who my grandpa played with in high school in a jazz band. So you've got all of these connections and just the odds of that happening at, you know, having Dan in the neighborhood, having Dan be willing to talk to my mom, having this character in the book that my grandpa knew the family of. So yeah, that was the point when my mom invited Dan over to talk to my grandpa about that book, you know, and talk about the Angus Hay family. And then Dan talked to Grandpa about his experiences in the Olympics and asked him whether he could write the book. So God,
what a small world. And
it is. It really is.
Sometimes I just think that the universe is sending us some sort of signal. And that sounds like one of those times.
That's exactly the way that we feel about it, too.
When you first read the book, how did that feel to read that story? And what did you think of what Dan did?
Well, we got to read it like all the way through the point in time where he was writing it. We would get a chapter at a time. So he worked really closely with my mom, actually, on the book. So my mom would get the chapters or the pieces that he was working on. And not only would she, you know, do the classic kind of just editing, spell check, that kind of stuff, but if there was something that she felt like didn't really represent my grandpa or my grandma or the situation, or if she thought that he was underplaying something that maybe she felt was more important, she would give him that input to just do a balance check on it, basically. It was very interesting getting the chapters that he wrote, and especially for my mom. And a really great example of that is when he was working on the chapters for the Golden Ruby Mine, when Joe was maybe late elementary school and they had gone and he had been abandoned by the family there and had to go live with the school teacher and chop firewood and fill the wood stove to earn his keep. She had not realized that he was abandoned there. He had given Dan a lot of remembrances of Grandpa, because those were some of the things that he had remembered and she had written down. Those were all things that he directly told my mom, but he never said my family abandoned me or my stepmom kicked me out. I think that she was kind of under the assumption that he lived with them. But then when you put all of that evidence together, it became very obvious what actually happened. And it was kind of devastating to her, even though all the evidence and everything that she had collected totally focused right to that point. It was not something that she had thought about in that way. And then when he wrote that chapter and she read it, she was really upset.
So Dan Brown, as an author, is approaching this as a, you know, third party outsider, right, and is able to sit and talk with Joe and is able, yes, to get lots of information that maybe the family hadn't really even been considering. Right. So it sounds like you learned all sorts of new things about him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Definitely. Definitely. And it was very eye-opening. Well, and I think maybe less for my mom, because she had been getting this information from him and she was a generation closer to it. For me as a grandchild, you know, I just saw him as Grandpa.
The book has been a huge success, to say the least. Has the family been surprised by this overwhelming interest in the story of the 1936 UW crew?
I think yes is the answer to that. But I think that my mom always felt like the story was special and was worth telling, and that the attention that it got was truly deserved attention because the story is so powerful. But I don't think that there's any way in our wildest dreams that we ever could have imagined that things would have gone this way. So yeah, definitely very pleasantly surprised and happy and excited and thankful that everything kind of turned out the way that it did. And it's still a little surreal, to be honest. I mean, thinking about the fact that this is going to be a movie, I have not seen the movie yet. So I think that when I actually see it, then it's going to feel maybe a little bit less surreal in that sense. But
I think it would feel even more surreal.
it'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing it for sure.
Well, we met Eric, the University of Washington rowing historian.
Eric Cohen. He's awesome.
Eric Cohen at the Charles. And he said, His sort of word of caution was it's a very Hollywood version of the book. So if you're a real devotee of the story, you got to kind of shake it off a little and let it be George Clooney and it has the director. But I think one of the funny things about that book is that rowers across the board have said that there was one like tiny coxing error or something in the book, but otherwise he got it perfectly. And I know the big question was, had Dan Brown ever been on the water? Has he been on the water since? And I know the University of Washington, I think, took him out. Poor guy.
Think he's been out. I think he's been in a boat one, maybe two times. I know that he rode, he got to get in a boat. He and my mom did in Port Townsend in a wood shell.
Oh yeah.
So that was a fun thing for them to be able to do. But past that, it was all just talking to coaches, talking to rowers, going out in coaching launches and things like that. And just listening what people had to say about rowing and then putting that into his writing.
You've talked with us about going through an old chest in the attic and finding old memorabilia from your grandpa. What would you say is your favorite thing that you've found there?
Ironically, the thing that I found that I think is the neatest thing was that he had menus from the train when they went to Poughkeepsie in 1930, I think it was in 36 when they went, but it was menus that had pictures of the crew on one side because it was specialized for them. And then what the actual menu was for the 3 days that they were on the train. And it's stuff like stewed prunes and figs for breakfast. And it's just so 1930s in comparison to what you would see on a menu today. But I think that in terms of the thing that probably holds the most meaning, definitely his Olympic passport and the document that they had to carry around in Germany to go from place to place.
Rachel and I have been following that the Museum of History and Industry in Seattle recently opened an exhibit called Pulling Together, A Brief History of Rowing in Seattle, which I'm shocked that it took until now to do that, but I'm so glad that it's in concert with the film. And did your family donate some items to that exhibit?
Yeah. So every athlete got their own country's flag that was produced in Germany. So my grandpa has a flag that is a US flag, but America is spelled M-A-R-I-K-A on it.
So,
that was the piece that we donated. And that exhibit is really cool. I went through it on the day that it opened, and they've got a lot of neat stuff from the entire history of rowing in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, including the Husky Challenger, which is an eight.
Yes.
It's not the Clipper, which was rowed in Boys in the Boat, which you can see at the Conor Bearshaw House at University of Washington campus. But the Challenger was actually rowed over there. It was taken out of a bar in Port Townsend, put back together, I'm assuming checked and safety checked, and then rowed. I'm impressed that it was afloat after years in a pub, but they rowed it over and set a big opening event.
Yeah. And that boat, a little more backstory about it. So there's a women's rowing crew on Port Townsend called Tough as Nails, and they refurbished that boat and actually rowed it for a few seasons. They actually called it the Husky Colander because it had so many leaks in it when they were rowing it, which I thought was pretty funny. So, they gave it a nice shine up and then brought it over on a trailer. And that was really fun watching the Huskies row that across, because I did get to be there when that happened too. And that was fun to witness.
What do you think the legacy of this film will be for the rowing community?
I would hope that it would get people to try rowing, and that it just kind of keeps that history alive more than anything else. I mean, it definitely is something that the story itself tells so much about rowing in the Northwest and putting the Northwest on the map for rowing. And it's just nice not to lose that piece of history. I think that it actually probably long-term will mean more for people outside the rowing community as just a book about resilience and working through adversity.
So there's a boathouse which has your grandpa's name on it these days, the Joe Rance Boathouse.
Yes.
Can you tell us just quickly about that boathouse? And there seems to be a fundraiser happening right now.
Yes. Yeah, there is. So when I started rowing at North Cascades Crew on Lake Stevens. And the first, gosh, I want to say 6 years that I rode there, we didn't have a boathouse. So we had a trailer that was in a storage lot, and our launch was in a storage lot, and we'd have to trailer the launch and the boat trailer to North Cove to put the boats, rig the boats together, and even have practice. And then we got a little teeny spot to put a little teeny boat rack for a couple of years, but never had a boathouse to call our own. Probably, I'd say 2 years before I stopped rowing there, we started working on the Joe Rance Boathouse, which is now over at Davies Beach. And it's been great to be able to see all of my old teammates actually have a boathouse to call home, and to have it have Grandpa's name on it is definitely an honor. And they actually used some of the cedar from his cedar pile in Lake Forest Park to do some of the trim work on it, which is really cool. But they just went through a situation this last year where they swapped the docks out at Davies Beach, and they didn't include a dock that was rowing inclusive. Uh-huh. So they had to dip into their funds to be able to pay to help have a dock put in that you could actually row off of. So they were out of their facility for 11 months while they were getting the stock put in, and it really depleted their resources. They're trying to replenish their resources to sure. be able to make sure that they have money to operate.
Yeah, we'll be sure to include the link on our website.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jen, this has been super fun. Thank you for taking so much time with us. We're excited to see the film and excited to see where this takes our rowing community.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to seeing the movie, so we'll see how you like it.
Yeah, yeah. Give it a thumbs up, thumbs out. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Hopefully it'll be a thumbs up.
Yeah. To see photos of Jen and Joe, the famous menu, and get links to the people, clubs, and events mentioned in this episode, check out the show notes on our website.
Thanks to a special group of our patrons, Jill M., Bobby K., Dave H., Arthur W., Lenore A., Chelsea V., Stephanie M., KCD, Alan M., whose support helps make this podcast possible. Join our team for as little as $5 a month at steadystatenetwork.com/Patreon.
Steady State Podcast is sponsored in part by RowSource, providing creative design services for clubs, organizations, and regattas. Get the design help you need at RowSource.com.
Tara, I think some listeners might not know that Steady State is more than a podcast.
True. We should definitely tell them about Friday mornings when we get together for coffee chat. We talk about rowing, racing, technique, and deep dive into things like inclusion and leadership.
Yeah, so we hope that you'll join us Friday mornings at 8 a.m. West, 11 East, live on Instagram. Grab your favorite mug and be a part of the conversation.
And sometimes we all need buddies to get us through workouts on the erg. So we lead Steady State Sundays once a month at 6:45 a.m. West, 9:45 a.m. East. Join us on the third Sunday of the month until March.
When folks sign up for this free 60-minute virtual erg workout, we provide cues and insights to keep them motivated along the way. You can register at steadystatenetwork.com/steadystatesunday.
This episode was written, produced, hosted, and edited by me, Tara Morgan.
And me, Rachel Friedman. Tara provides additional audio engineering and is our sponsor coordinator.
Rachel manages our website, social media, and e-newsletter. Our theme music is by Jonas Hipper. Between us, we have nearly 40 years of rowing, coaching, and coxing experience.
Tara is based on Vashon Island, Washington. She founded Seize the Oar Foundation in 2013 and is fanatic about coaching Learn to Row. She also believes the pair is the best boat.
Rachel is a longtime rower, coach, and coxswain in Washington, D.C. She's the owner of RowSource and is a tiny bit squeamish about sculling.
Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Steady State Network, Seize the Oar, and RowSource. In two way enough, that's one, two.